for the Post. Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says people's participation in elections helps the country gain major advantages at the international level. And Israeli forces attack Palestinian protesters marching in Jerusalem al-Quds against a controversial rally by settlers earlier this week. Hello and welcome, everybody. This is our top story for this half hour. Election day in Iran has commenced. People are heading to the polls across the country to choose a new president for the next 4 years. More than 59 million Iranians are eligible to cast ballots. Voters will choose a successor to incumbent President Hassan Rouhani. Four candidates are running for the post after three dropped out of the race on Wednesday. People are also voting in the country's city and village council elections, midterm elections for parliament, and assembly of experts will also be held concurrently in a number of cities. Well, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has cast his ballot in the country's presidential election. Ayatollah Khamenei called for a high turnout in the vote. Iran's leader said people's participation in elections helps the country gain major advantages at the international level. Therefore, he said, every single vote is cast is important, and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani cast his ballot as well. He also called on people from all walks of life to participate in the election. Rouhani said a high turnout will frustrate Iran's enemies. Well, Iranian voters have shared their views with us regarding the country's 13th presidential election and their expectations for their next from their next president. Let's take a listen.
I hope that the candidate I will vote for will be able to overcome the economic, social, political, and cultural problems that exist and to move the country forward through his actions and save the people from economic, cultural, and social deprivation.
I'm here make a glorious, happy Iran, which has been deprived of hope for 8 years, and I'm here to vote for a president who is the best, who is the most honest, and the right president is a person who stands by his people and keep his words. He should stick to his pledges, and we want to build hope for hopeless youth who have no hope in the future.
I vote for someone who can pay attention to domestic affairs, raise the value of the national currency, curb liquidity and inflation, and pay attention to domestic production.
President's place is very important in Iran. For this reason, all the Iranians must give their votes to choose their president. Since 1979, we make this democratic way to choose our president. It make us giving our choice, giving our leader to choice our president to continue our life in this region.
We are making a decision for the future of our country. We're voting in the hope of improving the country's economic situation and the people's livelihood.
Today the elections began in the whole city of Najaf and the whole of Iraq in three different centers, Baghdad, Najaf, and the whole city of Karbala. The elections were held with complete transparency.
I'm participating in this election for my country, for my leader, and my religion, for all those martyrs like General Soleimani who sacrificed their lives for us. I consider it my duty to vote.
The Governor General of Tehran Province, Anushiravan Mohseni Bandpei, says people are casting ballots at nearly 6,000 polling stations across the province. He says a strong turnout would foil plots of Iran's adversaries.
In Tehran province, there's over 6,000 polling stations have opened. And as the elections have started at 7 a.m. local time, people from different walks of life enthusiastically and energetically headed to the polling stations, men, women, children, while observing health protocols and in a peaceful atmosphere, cast their ballots. And fortunately, one of the many enemy plots that took a different form this year through spreading dismay and disappointment to dissuade them from taking part in the elections. This plot has been foiled and rendered ineffective by people's great presence. And
Yunus Hamami Lalazar is the religious leader of Jews in Iran. He says the Jewish community has been integrated into Iranian society despite enemies' attempts to divide them.
There are several elections today, and the presidential election is the most important one that chooses the chief executive of the country. And based on the decisions made by the president will be part of the destiny of the nation. And we are part of the Iranian society, and we have come here to make the best choice. And we want to choose the best individual for this position, because to participate in the election is a right, it's an obligation, and every citizen has the right to play his role and have his share in order to make the best choice. That's an old policy of divide and rule. That's been a policy to create a rift, and they want to, in this way, proceed with their wishes. So we are somehow entangled with a war. It was the post-war in the past, and we could see the enemy using weapons against you, attacking you. But in recent years, there's been an economic war due to the tyrannical sanctions imposed on the Iranian nation. In the meantime, they want to portray themselves as friends, but the Iranian nation is vigilant. During the years of imposed war, all the strata of the society from different religions, by following the path of the Imam, the people became united, and today we have to follow the leader and stay united and make the best choice in order to come up with the best results.
The spokesman of Iran's Constitutional Council, Abbas Ali Kathrouda, told Press TV about the monitoring process across the country on election day.
There has not been cases of irregularities. There was only a delay in the start of the electoral process in some polling stations. That's been due to a disruption in the identification system. And through cooperation with colleagues at the Interior Ministry, the problem was eliminated very quickly. There may be some technical difficulties in these systems, and also the city and village councils are fully electronic, and it's not through the systems. It was decided that in case of any delay by the system causing hardships for the people, the organizers and supervisors must make efforts in order to do the job manually in order to prevent any problem. In addition to having healthy election, people's health must also be protected. That was taken into account by the Constitutional Council. We cooperated with the Interior Ministry and the coronavirus headquarters. Very good proposals were made, and the issue of disinfecting the equipment and the polling station and observing social distancing and to have the polling stations in outdoor spaces. And due to the coronavirus pandemic, one health observer is present at every polling station to observe the health protocols.
Political analyst Mohammad Marandi says elections are regularly held in Iran as part of efforts to uphold democracy, despite the fact that certain countries are seeking to undermine those efforts.
When one takes into account the fact that Iran is facing maximum pressure sanctions, when the region, thanks to the United States and its allies, has been in chaos and is partially destroyed from Afghanistan to Iraq to Syria, Lebanon, Gaza, Yemen, Libya, wherever you look, the Americans have brought about destruction. All of that has impacted us. We are surrounded by military bases. We see hundreds of Persian language media outlets owned or funded by Western regimes and the Saudis working day and night to undermine the country. Under those circumstances, the Iranians carry out regular elections, which are, there is very open debate. When you look at the three debates we had on television, the candidates said almost everything that you can hear. Even when you watch Persian language Western media outlets, a lot of what was said on Iranian TV was the same as what they say, but in a more polite way.
Political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas believes consistently huge voter turnout in Iran's elections are the result of the Islamic Republic's regard for democracy and the rights of the people.
The Iranian people have acquired this right and this freedom to what I describe as a religious democracy through blood, sweat, and tears. The revolution was not some kind of operation which came from top down. It wasn't a military coup d'etat. It wasn't the elite, if you like, overthrowing the king of Iran at that time, the Shah of Iran. It was the people, and it's those people whose generation, subsequent generations are also emerging that do value this religious democracy in a way that many Western, people, particularly the establishment and the institutions that essentially want to bring down this system of governance, this establishment, would not understand or don't want to understand it in many cases. I think that the voter turnouts, which have been consistently huge, are the result of a real value for democracy and the right of the people. I think that that's the first thing. So the resistance mentality, of course, that you would refer to adds to this, because having been under the cosh, under sanctions, under US and Western, if you like, bullying, both economic terrorism, military terrorism, any other form of psychological terrorism that you can imagine, it's been incessant, non-stop, since 1979, and it's only got worse and worse.
Well, Iran has registered 127 more COVID-19 fatalities in 24 hours, raising the overall death toll to more than 82,700. The health ministry also confirmed over 10,000 new infections for the past day. The country's total caseload now stands at around 3.1 million. More than 2.7 million people have so far recovered from the deadly disease across the country. Iran has been witnessing a downward trend in cases and deaths since April. That's when the government imposed strict nationwide restrictions to curb the virus surge. Iran also launched its vaccination program in early February. So far, nearly 4.3 million people have received the first dose of a COVID vaccine. Around 900,000 people have been fully vaccinated across the country. Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian protesters in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds, making arrests. Palestinians were protesting outside the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound against a controversial march by Israeli settlers earlier this week. During the Tuesday rally, the Israeli settlers insulted Islam's Prophet Muhammad and chanted death to Arabs under the protection of Israeli forces. A so-called March of Flags also triggered protests in the besieged Gaza Strip. Resistance groups there warned the Israeli regime of consequences for allowing such controversial moves. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has slammed the latest Israeli airstrikes on the besieged Gaza Strip. A Hamas spokesman said the strikes on resistance sites were a demonstrative show by the new Israeli cabinet. Fawzi Barhum said the attacks were an attempt to boost Israeli soldiers' morale in the wake of their defeat in last month's aggression on Gaza. Barhum said resistance groups are determined to defend the rights of the Palestinian people at any price. Israel hit 10 targets in Gaza Thursday night in response to what it called incendiary balloons sent from the territory. On May 10th, the regime launched an 11-day onslaught that killed nearly 260 Palestinians. It ended after a truce with Hamas. Yemenis have held a symposium in the capital city of Sana'a to discuss the decades-long Israeli aggression against the Palestinians. The symposium is aimed at raising awareness on the importance of supporting the Palestinian cause. Abdul Latif al-Moshani has more in this report.
Jerusalem is closer than ever is the slogan of a symposium held in Yemeni capital Sana'a to discuss the Israel's long-lasting atrocities against the Palestinian nation. The organizers say the recent 11-day war has proved that the third generation of Palestinians is more capable of standing against Israel. They say the resistance has got stronger despite the normalization efforts of some Arab states.
The axis of resistance was able to prove its existence despite all the conspiracies of the closest people. There are Arab countries that are considered close to the Palestinian resistance, but unfortunately, they continue to stab the resistance through normalization with the Zionist entity. And these countries are the ones who seek to weaken and bring down the resistance. Today, the third generation of the Palestinians is capable more than ever of defending Palestine against Israel's aggression.
The gathering also hailed the support of allies for Palestinian cause, including Iran, who they say has always backed the Palestinian nation overtly. The participants said Iran has played a key role in changing the balance of the war between Palestine and the Israeli regime.
Since the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran 40 years ago, it has made Palestine its main issue, as Imam Khomeini declared that Iran's independence will not be complete without the liberation of Palestine. The Palestinian cause is at the heart of Iran's political strategy, and despite the conspiracies that Iran has gone through, it still supports the Palestinian resistance and has been a key factor in changing the equation of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
The Palestinian cause is also an issue of consideration for several other Islamic states, including Yemen. Last month, Yemenis launched a fundraising campaign to support the Palestinian resistance groups, even though they are going through a tragic humanitarian situation due to the ongoing Saudi war on their country.
People here believe that armed struggle is the only way to stand against aggressors. They say the recent victory proved that the Palestinian nation is on the right path to regain its rights.
Well, that's a wrap for this edition of the World News.
Diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Licensed civilian gun bearers in occupied Palestine, predominantly Jewish men, are openly encouraged by the Zionist regime to shoot to kill alleged or perceived Palestinian
people. On the night of May 16th, Jewish shooters reportedly arrived in the occupied East Al-Quds neighborhood of Shafat in four cars, opened fire on Palestinian residents, and injured two, says Rella Mazali Ryder in an article titled, Israeli Gun Owners Are Licensed by Zionist Regime to Kill Palestinians. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The Zionist regime's bombing has stopped, at least for now. But we need to talk about guns as well as bombs and neighborhoods as well as territories. Indeed, the Israeli regime's small arms policies and its war policies are directly and indirectly linked. Licensed civilian gun bearers in occupied Palestine, predominantly Jewish men, are openly encouraged by the Zionist regime to shoot to kill alleged or perceived Palestinian people. On the night of May 16th, Jewish shooters reportedly arrived in the occupied East Al-Quds neighborhood of Shafat in four cars, opened fire on Palestinian residents, and injured two. Tellingly, reports noted that the shooters were licensed gun bearers. A week earlier, Jewish men shot and killed 32-year-old Musa Hassuna from dozens of meters away, near his home in Lod, inside the occupied Palestine. A demand for their release from police custody, where they were held for interrogation, was tweeted the next day by the Zionist regime's public security minister, who lauded the shooters as licensed gun carriers. In recent years, the Israeli regime's policies on small arms have taken an ominous, aggressive turn. The current sharp spike in license applications is a direct result of these policies, as well as a response to the recent eruption of violence. According to data obtained by Gun Free Kitchen Tables, GFKT, a coalition of civil society organizations aiming to disarm homes and streets and to tighten gun controls, in the past 5 years, gun licensing authorities have issued more than 100,000 new civilian licenses. This trend has been strongly protested by the coalition, which has also contested it in the Zionist regime Supreme Court. New data on shootings of women in the occupied Palestine already seems to reflect the lethal results of the regime's policies. In 2020, the number of women shot dead with a licensed gun in the occupied Palestine was 2.5 times the average number of female gun victims in the preceding 4 years combined. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime police have been over and under policing Palestinian cities and towns inside the occupied Palestine for decades. They have made disproportionate numbers of often arbitrary arrests while knowingly enabling the stockpiling of unlicensed firearms. According to GFKT's research, these are mostly procured from military and other licensed sources, and they increasingly arm criminal groups. Nearly 100 Palestinian citizens were killed in 2020, mostly with guns, far outnumbering Jewish casualties in the same period, though the community forms just 20% of the population. For more than a decade, Palestinian leaders have been pleading with the Israeli regime's officials to stem the flow of arms into their communities. The regime has done nothing. No ministers will be demanding the release of the detained Palestinians, certainly not the public security minister who is in charge of the police. Police will not duplicate the kind of support they provide for attacks by the right-wing groups whom they give full access to Palestinian neighborhoods without intervening. During 1 week of the unrest in May, the Zionist regime police reportedly arrested 850 Palestinian citizens of the occupied Palestine compared with 150 Jews. At the same time, there are great attention-grabbing ploys to sidestep the failing governance of those in power. This is precisely the same algorithm that has yielded the Zionist regime's war policies. This fake regime appears to have zero interest in reducing violence or preserving lives, especially not Palestinian lives. Supremacy and expansion, and above all, clinging to power, Trump lives and blocks any possible moves towards negotiated political solutions. The only solutions envisioned are force, bombs, and guns. This is why the fake regime of Israel is fast unraveling.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Iran Today.
Foreign policy has been a priority with Iran's outgoing government. A landmark deal was struck early in Hassan Rouhani's 8 years in office. That was the JCPOA, which won't be revived by Iran's June the 18th presidential elections Friday. So, it will be a major challenge the next president will inherit, alongside several other foreign policy challenges. However, each challenge can be transformed into an opportunity of equal weight if handled with the right proportions of recognition, diplomacy, and firmness. What challenges will the next president face besides the 2015 JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal? Which ones ought he prioritize and turn into an opportunity, and how? These are questions we'll be answering with a look at the legacy passed down by the current administration here on Iran Today. Welcome to another election special with me, Leila Faromaisi. To begin with, the present administration's pet policy, the JCPOA, was both a milestone achievement and a heavy weight that fell back on the country when the former U.S. administration unilaterally withdrew from it in 2018. Mr. Hassan Beheshtipour is a steadfast believer in that nuclear deal. He joined us on Skype to walk us through the Rouhani era and paint a picture of a future in the hands of any of today's seven presidential candidates.
Mr. Rouhani managed to resolve an international dispute and to put an end to documentations against Iran, which had been ongoing for 12 years, by negotiating the JCPOA. This is significant. Some people inside the country indeed believe that the JCPOA didn't bring economic benefits for Iran. But the point is that the most important achievement of the deal was putting an end to the documentations against Tehran's nuclear program. They had made serious accusations against Iran, which, under the deal's so-called past and future issues, ended forever in November 2015 in the Board of Governors. This was a huge achievement. These were the issues that were used to pass six resolutions against Iran and put it under Article 7 of the United Nations Charter, unfairly describing it as a threat to international peace and stability.
So, it will be a major challenge the next president will inherit, one of several foreign policy challenges. If the current government doesn't conclude talks before the new government takes office on August the 3rd, that will likely be a principalist government skeptical of the US and the West. But then, decisions on strategic issues are not ultimately the government's to make alone. The president does chair the Supreme National Security Council, SNSC, and has some influence on its composition. And strategic decisions are often made in a consensual manner, but ultimately they require the approval of the leader of the revolution. Now, in this stage, talks are being facilitated by Europe, or are they? The JCPOA was signed between Iran and the P5 plus one. That's the US, UK, France, Russia, China, and Germany. It was to limit Iran's peaceful nuclear program in return for sanctions relief for this country. Trump's America pulled out and made sure that doesn't happen. Iran remains committed in a deal that Western European parties purported to rescue by devising a way around U.S. sanctions and the dollar for trade transactions. That didn't materialize, and today they are simply intermediaries in Vienna talks. But the talks are close to overspilling beyond the Rouhani government's lifespan and its JCPOA partners' golden opportunity. Perhaps Europe's ultimate goal is not to get the JCPOA back on its feet.
Mr. Rouhani invested too heavily in ties with Europe. The Europeans showed that they were powerless in the face of the U.S. monetary hegemony. Because when Trump withdrew from the JCPOA, or in other words, ended his commitments under the deal, the Europeans were unable to uphold the 11-point pledges they had made to Iran. Therefore, one of the mistakes Mr. Rouhani's government made was being over-reliant on the Europeans, who didn't do anything for us. But of course, Europe stood against the U.S. demand for triggering the so-called snapback mechanism, rejecting it with 11 abstained votes. Also, the Europeans abstained from voting for a U.S.-proposed draft resolution seeking an indefinite extension to an arms embargo on Iran.
Of course, Europe's approach may not be a determining factor, as U.S. President Biden insists on the continuation of Trump policies as leverage in negotiations. Europe's role is actually one of coordinator, and it is using its capacities to help in pressuring Iran into accepting terms beyond JCPOA demands. That is to control or even scrap this country's defensive ballistic missile program and its influence in West Asia. Two demands Iran finds outrageous and insulting. Iran also does have the opportunity of showing more goodwill by accepting FATF terms and agreeing to return to full compliance with the deal in return for the U.S.'s lifting of only nuclear deal-related sanctions, FATF being the Anti-Money Laundering Financial Action Task Force. But this country feels no obligation because it was the U.S. that pulled out of the deal to begin with, and that was a deal that laid Iran bare to surveillance and sabotage. Talking of turning challenges and problems into opportunities, Iran and Europe have plenty of common interests to consider in matters such as energy, the fight against drugs, the fight against terrorism, and advanced technologies to enjoy. The path to getting there is detente and confidence building that would result in purposeful interaction. But that's enough on a single deal that Iran cast most all of its chips into. There's a world beyond out there. In the absence of a Western alliance, Russia and China have been powerful allies to Iran, even overpoweringly so. By 2019, China had gained control of under 48.5% of Iran's exports and 27.5% of the country's imports. There's no place like home, and it's regional alliances that Iran and its neighbors must recall for their very livelihood in their match against nature itself. Water scarcity paints a scary future when 12 out of the 17 most water-stressed states in the world are in the Middle East and North Africa. Iran and its Arab neighbors to the south must cooperate to promote water security while minimizing harm to the Persian Gulf's ecology. Attention tends to focus on geopolitical challenges and economic exchange, but working together on water might open the way for meaningful cooperation on other issues. Focusing on the usual concerns, however, Mr. Beheshtipour talks of lost time with Saudi Arabia.
Mr. Rouhani's failure includes Iran's relations with Saudi Arabia. Of course, those who stormed the Saudi embassy and set it on fire were responsible for the strained relations, but Mr. Rouhani was unable to improve the ties afterward. This continued until recently before negotiations with Saudi Arabia kicked off. We hope the talks are successful, because resolving the problems between Iran and the Saudi Arabia will have a considerable impact on ending the devastating war on Yemen. It will also leave a positive impact on Iraq's stability and security.
While we're on the subject of neighbors, the current government got to enhance ties with Turkey, Iraq, and Afghanistan. And it got to solve some problems with its Azerbaijan ties, as well as differences in relation to Turkmenistan and the purchase of gas. Our analyst awarded Rouhani and his foreign policy team that praise, but said how balance must be maintained henceforth. The sum of it all sketches a close-up of Iran in total, its situation and status on the world scene. Geopolitics are a determining factor. Iran is the bridge between East and West, and any government can make the most of this natural positioning if it plays its cards right.
Another important point about Iran is its population. Iran is a country of over 80 million. Its people are highly educated. Its youth have excellent abilities and have shown them in different historic projects, like the nuclear program. They are self-reliant and have been able to do a lot. Therefore, Iran has the capacity to produce knowledge. It has the power of its population. It has economic power.
Ultimately, to our guests, the most important political game now is the challenge and opportunity that is the very JCPOA. Iran can live without it, but should it come to an agreement over that nuclear deal, it will have found a well-designed pattern for international exchanges. And those will facilitate better utilization of domestic capacities even. Whatever plans the different candidates have for different economic issues would make or break them in the presidential race. Issues are inflation, poverty, unemployment, and skyrocketing prices for basic household goods. Principalists or conservatives blame problems on the Rouhani administration's looking to the West to solve the country's economic woes. The question today is, what will they, the candidates, bring to the table? Dr. Shaghoghi is Dean of Khwarazmi University's Faculty of Economy. He came to share his views with us at Press TV Studios.
Any cabinet that will take office would face these problems and challenges, which have escalated compared to the previous decade. As time passes by, the problems worsen. Another point to mention is that all the think tanks are predicting by 2030 no country would buy oil. This means an end to the oil exports era.
Dr. Raghfar is an economist teaching at Al Zahra University, where we met him. He mentions the main reason for a high inflation rate.
The main reason behind the rise of inflation in Iran is what's called the costs push, which is mainly caused by currency manipulation. Iran's inflation has ranged somewhere about 14 to 15% when there haven't been wild fluctuations in the value of our national currency. But in the past 8 years, the inflation in Iran averaged 24%. The highest inflation level was recorded last year at 50%. It was mainly caused by the devaluation of the national currency, as I just mentioned.
Hassan Rouhani didn't inherit a bed of roses when he started out as president in 2013. International sanctions had been tightened in 2011, and inflation was at over 30%. And there appeared no way out but to negotiate a deal with the world's economic powers. That would be the JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal with the P5+1, the US, UK, France, Russia, China, and Germany. They would lift the UN's nuclear-related economic sanctions off this country in return for Iran limiting its peaceful nuclear program. The US pulled out, however, in 2018 and made things worse for this country.
The 11th government took office with a promise to solve Iran's nuclear-related issues, lift sanctions, and improve the country's international ties. But the nuclear negotiations that were expected to be wrapped up fast took about 2 to 2.5 years to conclude. Even after the JCPOA was reached, several issues, including banking relations, were left unsolved. The government put all its eggs in the basket of the nuclear deal.
Although it may not be tangible, the Rouhani government is said to have kept the economy afloat when it could have actually drowned by U.S. sanctions, the oil revenues frozen abroad, and the COVID-19 pandemic. Not sure our Dr. Raghfar agrees.
It appears to me that we have all the resources to fund the public sector, but there isn't a political will to get that done. The fact that the government hasn't turned to taxes and that Iran's tax system is flawed and inefficient depends on how much they fit the interests of the decision makers.
Now, Iran's problem is indeed also corruption and mismanagement, not just external sanctions. Whatever weakness or malice and vice the government may have, it is not the ultimate force in the country to carry all the blame. The government needs tax revenues it cannot extract from the most powerful institutions or invisible incomes. It attempted selling bonds for public companies and enterprises, but those basically didn't land in the palms of actual private companies and investors who get the industry running and so create jobs. Dr. Hakhshanas is a prominent economist who was, for his tireless capability, appointed governor of Golestan province when floods swept over the country in 2019. He joined us on Skype.
What the incumbent administration did was, instead of borrowing from the central bank and injecting stronger money into the economy, it attempted to address the budget deficit by selling treasury bills or other securities worth 200 trillion tumans. If the government didn't take this initiative, Iran's economy could sink into hyperinflation, as many experts were predicting following Donald Trump's withdrawal from the JCPOA in 2018.
Plenty of solutions suggested by economists, but do any plans and ideas put forth by presidential candidates read with those solutions to economic woes? Let's hear it from an expert. Have you seen any concrete economic plans by the presidential candidates?
I haven't seen any candidate with a comprehensive plan so far. I don't know if they have a plan, but they are yet to publish their agenda through the media or on their websites. The plans have to incorporate the priorities
including doors for reforms, operations, how to address major challenges, their quantifiable goals, approaches and strategies. You see, a team of doctors must have a plan that identifies the challenges facing the patient, prioritize which ones to address first, and determines the necessary treatment.
It's come to that time when any guess as to who the next president is can be second-guessed, when the expected outcome can make a U-turn. That's because electoral debates are underway. The first round was on Saturday, the 5th of June, and that was the economic round when candidates could have recreated their destinies. Overall, the debate between the seven candidates wasn't impressive. Although the seven were to respond to predetermined questions, they basically seized the opportunity to respond to criticisms and attack one another and the outgoing Rouhani administration, or to promote their own plans.
We need to do things like levying taxes on non-productive jobs and at the same time reducing taxes on producers.
When we carefully study the matters, we realize that the government's relationship with the economy and the economies with the people haven't been adjusted. Whenever the government faces a problem, it delves into the pockets of the people.
Dear Iranians, your economic conditions can be improved a lot, but that necessitates reforms that the other candidates can't make. But I have the plan and the ability to do so, dear people.
Unfortunately, in our country, the relevant authorities have become responsible for the protection of foreign currency instead of being responsible for protecting the value of the national currency.
Statistics show that almost 50% of people live below the poverty line. This doesn't befit the honorable people of Iran, that 7 million heads of households don't earn a fixed income and need direct assistance to make a living.
The volume of liquidity is more than 3,500 trillion tomans. This is brought about by banks producing money without the supervision of the central bank, creating super debtors. Currently, there are 11 super debtors who owe the economy 90 trillion tomans.
Before making plans to fight poverty, you need to ensure that you have the attitude for it. Do you have what it takes to fight poverty? One of the problems we have had over the past years has been that the people and the underprivileged haven't been the priority.
But for the better part, the debate circled around criticizing the present government's policies and Abdel Nasser Hemmati's efficiency when chief of the CBI, Central Bank of Iran.
Dear Mr. Hemmati, you have sources to make kingpins for steel, sugar, and cooking oil, but you don't have resources to help the poor. He has destroyed the national currency. Now he's talking about the distribution of poverty. You have distributed poverty.
For instance, Mr. Hemmati said why the FATF hasn't been approved, claiming that he knows so much about the issue is why the economy is in the condition it is right now.
Hemmati, for his part, tried to exempt himself from the government's policies, saying Hassan Rouhani lacked economic vision.
First of all, let me say at the outset that I'm not Mr. Rouhani's representative. I was set aside from the central bank because of disagreements I had with Mr. Rouhani. He had the same problem you do. He didn't have economic insight. I urge everyone to consider this. Mr. Raisi said two groups of economists can comment. But if you don't have economic insight, which group do you listen to? It's an issue that's been solved everywhere in the world. Anyone who makes economic decisions must have economic insight.
I asked how Hemmati had won the reputation with many of having kept the inflation and decline of the rial under check against all odds. The many don't include our economist.
In an 8-year period, when Iran saw war, occupation, political coup, and other turning points, only once the national currency fell sixfold. That happened in a 3-year period when Mr. Hemmati was in charge.
Mohsen Mehralizadeh praised the 8-year performance of the Khatami government, calling his own policies a continuation of that reforms government.
People of Iran, all the statistics and political, social and historical indicators are a testament to the fact that one government managed to advance the country appropriately toward development by moving slowly, steadily and logically. That was the reformist government of Sayyid Mohammad Khatami.
As for Saeed Jalili and Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi, those were the two candidates that focused on introducing their own plans more than the others did. This means they spent less time on attacking fellow candidates.
You need to be able to create jobs, not add employees. This means that your agricultural sector should be able to do this. We checked how much work can be done in the petro-refinery sector, petrochemical, oil and gas projects, and energy consumption optimization. Also in agriculture, fisheries, farms, animal husbandry, and etc. We have transformative plans for each of these.
We've been making plans with the help of revolutionary youth over the past 3 years under the title of Salam Government. I can address the production barriers, structural budgeting, non-repayment of debts, bank debtors, and tax issues.
In saying why he wanted to leave the judiciary for the executive, Mr. Raisi highlighted his fight against corruption, the source of which he said was mostly the executive, which he wants to reconstruct.
During my tenure in the judiciary, I faced numerous cases which are traced back to the executive branch of the government. I mean legal cases of corruption and economic rights. We investigate these cases with a steady perseverance. People know well that I know no borders in dealing with corruption cases, and it's been proved to them that I'm not all talk. I'm a man of my words. It's a key point that today we need to promptly deal with and correct the branch of the government which is producing such cases.
We popped out to see what people on the street were thinking, how attractive they found the candidates and their mottos. We also asked people whether they associated economic problems with sanctions or domestic mismanagement.
The point is that sanctions have become an excuse for mismanagement inside the country. If they select qualified managers with relevant knowledge and expertise to the area of their activity, we won't have the problems that we have today in the country.
I wish there were more severe laws against presidents who simply forget about their campaign slogans as soon as they win the elections. That's my personal idea, though. Because in that case, they will stay in office for 4 or 8 years and just exacerbate the problems.
For me, who is grappling with problems of life every single day, baseless slogans won't do any good. In fact, we've been able to find ways around the sanctions, but unfortunately, mismanagement is still prevalent throughout the country.
Sanctions will not always be like this. Things will work out. Actually, we need to find a way to cope with mismanagement.
Pressure of sanctions is undeniable, but still the country enjoys enough potentials to flourish. The fact of the matter is that we've heard loads of these slogans since many years ago, but it's not enough. A tongue doesn't get things done.
That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.